Thank you very much.
I don't think we saw your images, your pictures. I saw them. And one or two people have put messages on the speaking queue to say they didn't. I don't think it made a lot of difference in that I don't think it detracted because you did describe pretty clearly what the pictures depicted. I don't know if anybody else saw them, but for me, it didn't work.
Right.
But never mind. Don't worry about that. We certainly got the point and all the points, in fact, that the pictures made. Please feel free to. Sorry, John.
I'm just going to say that's good. I'm glad that people got and I was able to describe the pictures quite well. The pictures, the little collage I made up, I'd hoped to use it as a visual aid, but at the same time, it was actually an aid to me in that I could look at the pictures and talk about a little bit about the subject matter of each.
Yeah, okay. But never mind, anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there was some way of putting them on afterwards, I'm sure people would look at them, but I don't know whether there is or not. Maybe, you know, somebody could help with that. But anyway, right, on to questions and discussion. But maybe I can start, since nobody else is in the speaking queue at the moment, with a sort of bit of a reflection, a memory, really, of my own. I remember many years ago when I was a student and attending a lecture, I remember the lecturers talking about a writer. Oh, they're there now.
They've appeared. I forgot to press return. It's as simple as that. My God, that's a shame. But you will be able to see them at least now. They're in PDF files.
All right, I see. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Yeah, I like that. Nationalism teaches you to take pride in shit you haven't done and hate people you've never met. That's a good one. Definitely. Just saying that many years ago, I remember attending a lecture when I was at university and the lecturer talking about the writer he was lecturing on, saying that he was a true patriot, and a true patriot abhors narrow nationalism. In other words, he made a distinction between patriotism and nationalism, and some people do. But as you said, really, you know, the distinction is so sort of vague and impossible to define that it isn't worth making. I mean, all it means, as far as I can see, is there are some people who are nationalists, but a sort of rather nicer nationalists than others who aren't. That would be patriotism. Nasty nationalists, real nationalism, the nationalist who sort of hates people or simply ignores people, thinks other nations are inferior, that could be called nationalism. But it's a distinction without a difference, really. There isn't a great deal of point in making it. So, I mean, I think a good idea not to try and make that distinction. I don't think the party should make it either. It wouldn't get us anywhere, that's for sure.
No, George Orwell made that distinction, but although I was sympathetic to him, I just couldn't go with him on that one. I just thought, no, it's too fine a distinction. It's like you say, it's just nationalism, but they're a bit nicer going about it, you know.
Sorry, who did you say made the distinction?
George Orwell.
Oh, George Orwell. Right, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it sounds like Orwell. That. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. Would somebody else like to make a comment of some kind, a response to what's been a very interesting talk? Very interesting indeed. Would anybody else like to come in? Paddy, we've got you now. Go ahead.
Well, just a couple of things. I really enjoyed that, John. That was really interesting. I particularly like the way you sort of use humour. I mean, I think we don't do that enough. Maybe we haven't got the talent for it. But I definitely think with something like nationalism, I mean, it just really pays to sort of take the piss out of it a bit. And it sort of shows up how ridiculous it is. And I think you gave some really good examples of that. You know, I was kind of like laughing along, you know, as you were talking. So, you know, I really like that about what you did. But it occurred to me, I think something, the conversation that was just taking place, the sort of... you know, the equation of, I'm not quite sure if I understood it, because I was, I don't know if I was paying proper attention, but this sort of equation of nationalism and racism, but this was feeding into a thought that I had related to this. But I mean, I think for the, I would say for the sake of argument that I think you can probably be a nationalist, but it doesn't necessarily imply that you're a racist. You know, I think they're probably separate things, but I was thinking about nationalism in a sort of, in terms of, you know, in groups, identity groups and stuff like that. And it was occurring to me that, you know, people are nationalists at different times. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. I mean, you know, there's that well-known saying about people who watch sort of football matches when the national teams play and the 90-minute nationalist. I do. I can sometimes do it myself, you know. This kind of thing, and how nationalism sort of seems to drop below the radar for quite long periods of time. Like you see it in, you know, this country, it doesn't seem to be a particular issue. And then a war sort of breaks out or it might not even, you know, it might be somebody else's war, like with Ukraine at the moment. And then you get this sort of upsurge of nationalist sentiment and, you know, writ large in Ukraine at the moment. And so it occurred to me, people, what this is really about is what in-group people identify with. And it seems to me that what people identify with most depends on what they most feel threatened by. So... for example, if you take the example, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about identity politics in the past and how people, you know, people identify as, let's say, gay or black or, you know, so on and so forth. It doesn't mean that people who identify as gay are also anti-racist, because it can be the case that people who are gay are also racist. And it can be that... you know, women who identify as feminists can also be nationalist, let's say. So what am I doing? I'm talking around in circles. I'm just saying that what people identify with most depends on their circumstance at that moment and what they feel most threatened by. So I imagine before February in Ukraine, you had lots of people who identified, identity politics, who identified mostly as gay or mostly as disabled or mostly as black or mostly as women and so on and so forth. When the war breaks out, they forget all that, and now they identify as Ukrainian. Why am I saying this? Because in a sense, what's the implication for us? Because everyone is threatened by capitalism. This is what our case is. And hence our class case, you know, everyone has a common class interest. The problem is that for most people, for most of the time, that doesn't feel as real or immediate as their more sort of pressing concerns. You know, capitalism isn't going to beat you up on the street because you're gay. It's not going to, you know... you know, you're not going to experience domestic violence tonight when you go home as a result of capitalism, at least not directly. But you see what I mean? So people have got, you know, these much more pressing, direct personal concerns. And so our class case, I think, for a lot of people, seems quite remote, quite abstract, sort of intellectual, you know. And so therefore it gets shoved down the priority list compared with the more pressing concerns. I think that's probably true of, well, a lot of people, possibly most people. I'm simply flagging this as an issue. What? How do we respond to that? I mean, I can't. I'm not expecting you to be able to answer this, John. I'm just throwing this out there. How do we respond to this when people are kind of people out there? It's not that they're not interested in socialist ideas. Not interested. They're not interested in class consciousness. It's just that they are. They've got other much more pressing concerns that are worrying them. That maybe even life threatening. What do we do about that? How do we make our case feel viscerally real to those people rather than this rather abstract, remote, intellectual case that I think they perceive it as? Oh, there we are. That's me. I'm just throwing that out there.
I think whatever the answer might be, it's probably a lot easier said than done, whatever it is. But I did notice a similar thing with nationalism that I thought when I was much younger had, because I tended to only meet people that didn't have these ideas, and so it's easy to be lulled into a false sense of security. And when the Falklands War broke out, I was absolutely horrified by the outburst of nationalism and jingoism that took place, and all that "Hey Ho Britannia" stuff as the ships, as the task force left to kill the invaders in the Falklands. So you can think these ideas, backward notions of nationalism, are sort of on the wane, and then something happens, like a war, as you described in Ukraine, and that war in the Falklands in 1982, that really horrified me to see the jingoism that was still there.
Thanks, John. Alan, would you like to speak?
I find very contradictory is the left nationalists in Scotland, the SSP, the left wing in Catalonia, how they still claim to be internationalists when really what they're supporting are the wealthy regions of a country doing a shit on the poorer regions of the other parts of the country, and dividing the workers' resistance to employers and the government. I find it very contradictory that they claim to be internationalists and not separatists, and they can't see the link either to themselves and the right-wing Northern League of Italy, who is exactly the same, a prosperous part of Italy, who just want to separate themselves from the poor south of Italy. And I just find it very strange that they can still call themselves internationalists. I just find it very odd that they can't see the logical link that they are dividing the working class and not uniting them. That's really my only comment.
Yes, it's a thing I've noticed since, not just all the time I've been in the party, but even since before I joined. In 1975, just before I did join the party, I had got a tape recording of a meeting, a debate we had with some so-called Republican socialists of some sort, and they supported the idea of nationalism, but they claimed also to be socialists. And of course, the obvious question there, which I've asked a few times of such people, is, oh, would that be national socialist? And sometimes some of them don't get what it is you're driving at, which is really sad. You start to feel sorry for the people you set out to demolish. But yes, that's a thing that I've always noticed about these left-wing folk. And there was one, that meeting that I mentioned in the McClellan Galleries. I was out of Glasgow at the time and was happened to be in Isle of Mull at the time. But later on, I got to hear of this debate. And in the debate, one of the left-wing questioners asked our speaker why we didn't support these nationalist movements, because he made the case that to be an internationalist, you had to be a nationalist first, which I thought even then was rather perverse and silly. But that is the kind of nonsense these people end up trying to defend. I think they just get carried away with the whole romanticism of struggle for things and oppressed peoples, and they can help these people in some way because they are special people. And they have this notion of all these different struggles that you know, are really nothing to do, and quite often are imaginary struggles arising from imaginary identities. And this is just one of these problems that we have to continue to fight against.
Thanks, John. Nobody in the speaking queue at the moment. Just to say that you don't have to look very far to see examples of so-called socialist people who call themselves socialists also advocating nationalism. A prime example was in the Brexit referendum, where, you know, your standard sort of non-Labour Party left-wingers like the SWP, fairly quietly but quite definitely, were supporting Brexit, as were, you know, various other sort of left-wing organisations. You know, more nationalists you could not get, but, you know, they had a sort of funny, sort of contorted argument that somehow by Britain breaking away from the European Union, you were harming sort of international capitalism. Quite absurd, really. But, you know, that's what you find. And so there was support for Brexit from both the left and the right during the referendum in 2016. And interestingly, of course, the Labour Party now is saying that it wouldn't attempt to reverse that. It would carry on with it for all the difference it's made, I should say. And, you know, we said it at the time that it would make no difference to the plight of workers, and clearly it hasn't. Certainly hasn't made things any better, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the same thing would go for the Scottish Breakaway movement. But to me, on a personal level, I just see it as a damned inconvenient thing. As I get older, I don't really need this degree of hassle. You know, all this enthusiasm for something that's, you know, in advance can't work out. Of course, Scotland could be a separate country, but why? Why? I mean, it just seems silly in the 21st century that people should be trying to re-establish. I mean, the SNP argue that Scotland is an ancient nation, but that's just not true. Even England isn't an ancient nation. England didn't exist when the Romans left. That's when ancient times kind of, you could say, ended. So England didn't exist then, far less Scotland. So a lot of their notions as well are to try and give a great grandeur to the concept of their nation as compared to others, that it's an ancient thing and therefore somehow being ancient. I mean, what does that convey anyway? It's akin to the idea that religious people have about old books. Well, they're really old books, and so therefore they're probably true because they've got special knowledge in them that they never quite specify what the special knowledge is, but nevertheless it's in these old books.
Thanks, John. I mean, maybe one of the reasons we haven't got many people in the speaking queue is that there's very little to disagree with in what you said. You know, is there anything to add? Mike, you're in the speaking queue now. Do add something.
Thank you. Interesting discussion so far. And yeah, I enjoyed the talk as well. Yeah, thank you. What's popped into my head as a result of watching early this evening, and this is a guilty pleasure of mine, YouTube videos by people from the libertarian right, a sort of, you know your enemy kind of a pastime of mine. And one I was watching gave the viewpoint that with Boris Johnson resigning as Prime Minister, and people so far who've thrown their hats into the ring to say they want to go forward for the leadership race. This pundit on his YouTube video was pointing out the number of those candidates or potential candidates from ethnic minorities, and raising the question that because of their ethnicity and their backgrounds, they wouldn't be quite as loyal to Britain compared with an indigenous member of the population. And I think that obviously sort of raises awkward questions, especially for the right, given that the country is now much more diverse, and that has implications for how people perceive how the nation is defined sort of culturally. That I think I realize that's not something which concerns us, but it's something that both the right and the left get quite hot-headed about. And I think one way that the left has tried to reconcile nationalism with increased diversity is by emphasising the people from ethnic minorities through history. There's been several books, documentaries which highlight the number of people from non-white backgrounds in Britain during the Middle Ages, during the Victorian era, and so on, to emphasise that, with the aim of saying that Britain has always been diverse. That's a much more of a sort of a hot potato now than it was a few decades ago. And I think, again, that's something how identity politics has merged in a rather uneasy way on both sides with nationalism. And I think that because it's a fairly new emerging sort of strand of identity politics, it hasn't quite sort of worked its way through yet. I'm not quite sure where it's leading. But yeah, it's all... it's all a distraction, obviously, from sort of economic class reality, to get too focused on that, which both the right and the left seem to be doing. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
I was just going to say thanks as well. Yes.
Yeah. A bit surprised, Mike, that you get that kind of argument from the libertarian right. You certainly easily get it from the right, but the libertarian right, my sort of perception of them, my experience of them, is that they are sort of, pretty non-racist, as it were. It's the market that counts, not who's operating in the market. Are they right to think that an ethnic minority Tory leader would be sort of less effective because people would think they somehow weren't... didn't have full allegiance to the flag, to the country. I'm sure they're not right to think that, but I can't help feeling that if an ethnic minority MP were to become the leader of the Tory party, it would probably weaken them because of this sort of latent racism that exists in this country. People don't come out openly and say we don't like a particular candidate because they're black, because they're an ethnic minority. But nevertheless, I can't help feeling that when it came to voting, when it came to doing something silently, it would, it could well disadvantage the political party that had as its leader a member of an ethnic minority. Yeah. Alan, sorry, over to you.
It's okay. I let Alan go.
Oh, okay, John. Sorry. Yeah. Alan, go on. Yeah.
Just to mention Priti Patel being an ethnic immigrant and being the most anti-migrant, anti-refugee, anti-foreigner Home Secretary I've encountered for many a year. But I have to give the SNP credit, because during the 2014 referendum, they played their cards very clever by appealing to the migrant workers in Scotland. Scotland has a underpopulation problem, and the policy, which is unfortunately under the London rules, is to increase immigration to Scotland. And they put out a very good advert at the SNP where they had Poles, Eastern Europeans, people from all over the world who were living in Scotland, saying how they wanted independence. So this is one reason why I don't think the 2023 referendum is the same. Because if Scotland does get independence, they've got a different immigration policy, and they're going to, the Westminster government are going to have to put up barriers, fences, and a wall, and rebuild Hadrian's Wall to stop the movement of immigrants from Scotland into England. But again, you know, one of my arguments has always been, I don't know any family who hasn't got an English relation. I don't know any family that hasn't got friends, neighbours, well, friends and family members who live in England. We just can't separate ourselves. We're organically bound to our neighbours in the south, just like the Irish are probably bound to, with religion, to Glasgow in Scotland, and Rangers and Celtic. These things are organic. I don't know. I'm getting a bit confused myself about nationalism, because you do get that Irish nationalism looking towards foreign football teams. But anyway, before I start waffling, I better cut off now.
Thanks, Alan. John, any reflections there?
Well, I could. I just realised I didn't. I said that I would tell you what the Scottish Bluebell matches was all about, and England's Glory matches. So this might be an opportune moment to mention that. Some of you may have seen the thing that I'm about to talk about. It was an advertisement making use of both English and Scottish stereotypes, all for the purpose of selling matches. And I'll basically describe the advertisement. This was back in the 19, I think could have been late 70s or early 80s, maybe during the 80s sometime. But anyway, it was concerning a battle that was taking place, and I think it was perhaps depicting, say, Culloden or round about that time, the last of the Jacobite rebellions. And there's this little sorry-faced Scotch peasant boy who's trying hard to light the matches, to fire the cannon or whatever it is that they're tasked with. And he complains to his leader, "I can't get the matches to light." And then the next thing, it cuts to a scene with a stereotypical English officer on horseback, I think, who says, because in the interim period when it cut to the next scene, they must have switched to using Scottish Bluebell. And he says to the other ranks, "Back, lads, they're using Scottish Bluebell." And the funny thing about this advertisement is not just the use of the stereotypes, but the fact that the same company produces other matches called England's Glory. And these matches are produced by Bryant and May. And sometimes they were made in England, other times they were made in Sweden. The Bryant and May ones, it just says British made. But the point is that nationalism was being used to sell matches, essentially. So the same company was selling matches in England using a bit of English nationalism, English Glory, England's Glory. And in Scotland, it was under the title of Scottish Bluebell. So that was quite amusing. But the other thing about that company is that that's the same, you might recognise, Bryant and May as the company that was responsible for employing those girls in the 19th century who suffered all sorts of conditions due to working in their factories while their shareholders got tremendous profits of something like 20% yield on their dividends, on their investment. So, you know, that's the same sordid company that produced an amusing advertisement, but all the same, they do what they have to do to further their interests as a capitalist concern. And you see it in a lot of different things. You see it in particularly over the last few decades with the rise of nationalism in Scotland. You used to have South of Scotland Electricity Board. You now have an organisation called Scottish Power. Now, if you didn't know me, you'd think I was a nationalist by saying it shouldn't be called Scottish Power, it should be called Spanish Power, because it's actually owned by Iberdrola, which is a Spanish company. But as we know, capital is international, so it's not a thing that really worries us. But I'm sure it does worry some nationalists that their beloved Scottish Power is actually owned by Spanish, in the main Spanish capitalists. So that was the what started out as a story of the Scottish Bluebell matches.
Thanks, John. Adam, you're next in the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back to something that John said earlier with regard to Scottish separatism. I mean, what's the point? It'll just be extra hassle. I mean, it'll be a purely administrative change, but it'll cause unnecessary complications for people. You know, one of them is has just been mentioned. There's a big fuss now about the Irish Northern Ireland Protocol. I mean, it's easier to put a frontier down the in the middle of the Irish Sea, but I mean, if Scotland pursues a different, well, it's already mentioned a different immigration, but a different trade policy, what they're going to do? I mean, I think instead Alan is wrong. I don't think Hadrian's Wall is the border between England and Scotland. Anyway, there'll be a border and there'll be all sorts of administrative, you know, problems. I mean, I don't think I'm you know, betraying a secret, but I remember talking to Victor Vanney about the last referendum, and he says that one reason why he wasn't really in favour of it was worrying what was going to happen to his savings, and there'll be other problems like this. What's going to happen to people's you know, pensions? When Ireland got independence in 1921, they couldn't afford to keep up paying the pensions of civil service. One of the first acts was to you know, reduce the pensions of Irish civil servants. And similar things risk happening if you know, Scotland breaks away. So I mean, I personally, I can't think that workers in Scotland are so stupid as to vote for separatism, because it'll just mean you know, some extra hassle, extra administrative problems. Okay, after a few years, things will settle down, but the situation they'll find themselves in will be exactly the same as it is you know now. So I think, in fact, that this second referendum will be the result will be no, and to be honest, I think that's the best result.
Yes, well, I hope that's right, but unfortunately, I've discovered a lot of younger people seem to be taken in by it, perhaps because they've not been around long enough to realise some of the horrors that are in store towards the latter part of their lives. But but yeah, it's real practical difficulties like that. There's no reason why you couldn't have an independent Scotland, but why? It just seems an exercise in utter pointlessness, and it definitely would be of no significant benefit to. I mean, there wasn't even a section of the capitalist class that was interested in it. This is a thing that's been got up by all sorts of odd people over during the last century, and who started to make headway from the 1970s onwards, mainly due to the failures of, well, we know that capitalist parties can't do anything to help the the situation the workers are faced with, but the rest of the people don't know that, so they're casting about for, in desperation, for some other solution. And this one seems, it's these faraway people in London that are, let's face it, they're not helping their case very well if they want to keep this as a united kingdom. So for some years they've been helping the nationalists to make their case. And unfortunately, to people that are maybe not very well informed and are not paying close attention, someone like Nicola Sturgeon seems much more down-to-earth and honest than most of the politicians you hear at Westminster. So on a simplistic level, a lot of people are probably quite easily taken in by the nationalist case.
John, you say that a lot of young people seem to be sort of espousing the nationalist cause. But, I mean, wasn't that the case last time in the last referendum that the nationalists got more votes from the young sections of the population than the older ones?
I think that's right. I don't remember for certain, but I think that's probably right. It does ring a bell with me.
So yeah, the point I'm making is that, you know, is it likely to be much different this time if there is a referendum? I tend to agree with what Adam said, although, you know, you can't tell. I mean, you know, Brexit seemed a sort of a fairly remote possibility, but it did come to pass.
Yeah, there's so many things mixed up in it, because one of the things the SNP point out is that 62% of the Scottish electorate voted to remain. And so, again, they're being taken out of Europe against their will because of, these misanthropic parties in Westminster, particularly the Tories. The Tories are the ones that are really quite well hated here. Although there is a significant portion of Tories in Scotland, as I discovered with the devolved parliament, that in actual fact there's still Tories out there. It's just that they're rather shamefaced for the last few decades.
Tony, is it you there? Tony?
It's indeed, yeah.
Hi.
I just had a question, which was, there seemed to be a lot of stuff about people who'd, in the last referendum, it didn't matter whether you were pro-Brexit or pro-Remain, it was how you voted. But this time, all the Brexiteers are going over to the Unionist parties, and all the Remainers are voting SNP. So is that a change in who's going to vote for what?
No, I don't actually think this is the thing. This was a point that I meant to elaborate further on. The SNP claim all of this, that these two things marry up. But in actual fact, what they haven't considered is that a lot of these supporters that I kind of referred to earlier, the more nasty versions of the nationalists who think that a small country or any country can be self-sufficient in the world, and they even hate people in other parts of their own imagined country, and those sort of people, a lot of them would not want to be in Europe, and just Scotland would just spin off on its own into a little crazy little hyper-Scotch tartanised world of its own. Some of these people are that crazy. So the SNP is mistaken to just assume that because a majority voted to stay within the EU, that would mean that vote could just be carried across to support them and their independent state, which would be seeking to rejoin the EU. It's not as simple as that. A lot of their supporters are actually support that they willingly accept. I mean, I've seen Nicola having a bad time from some really virulent nationalists who are basically racists. And I must admit, she's She's not pandered to any of that. But the thing is, she'll accept these people's votes.
We've got nobody in the speaking queue at the moment. Anybody want to say anything further? We've had quite a decent discussion. It's a bit early, but we've had quite a decent discussion. Focused on Scotland, but why not? Janet, can we come to you then?
Yes, thank you. An interesting talk, and people have stirred up so many different strands of thinking that it's difficult to pin down a particular strand. I think one of the things that occurs to me is that people need or want to have a sense of belonging, and that is either being substituted by their feudal owners or the monarchy, or in particular a political party or some sort of... Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, sorry. And so if that's taken away, if the sense of nationalism or patriotism, because I've never been clear about those two words, is taken away from them, you have to then learn to stand alone and have your own ideas about society. And that means an awful lot of thinking and an awful lot of sorting out about where you do stand in relation to your neighbour across the street, across the town, across the country, across the world. It needs a whole different, the word is mindset these days, and it doesn't come easily. And there's so many other factors that are influencing people to feel differently. I used to say it was all the school's fault and education, but I'm not so sure that's so nowadays. And I think it's probably now the market, the capitalist market, makes people think that they're allied to a particular country, state. So there's all the football teams and all the sporting activities and the Tour de France is going on just now, and in that there's all these different people from different countries taking part, and it seems a really, really nice joint activity between countries, but it gets spoiled at the end by proclaiming the country from which the winner comes. And so everything comes back to a root, people having a root within their own lives. And when I gave up religion in my teens, because it seemed to me that it was an awful troublemaker and better to do without it, so I thought, well, I'll try to do without it. And after a year or so, I realised I hadn't needed it, hadn't missed it, and it was good not to have this awful religious background in my life. And then I went on to examine politics after that, and gradually, after many years, found the party. But that took a long time. It took a long time of thinking and examining and wondering. And so if other people have to go through that mental mechanism, it is an effort. It doesn't come easily, and it needs time. Needs time and thinking. And as we all know, many people are so busy now, busy with either work or leisure activities or both, and it's difficult to give time to thinking along a line of thought that leads you to a scientific conclusion. In the political world, political economic world. And so it isn't easy. And even when we do find someone who listens to us sympathetically, they often say, oh, yes, but it will never work. Good idea, but it will never work. Because to go back into their own life and think of trying to apply the socialist ideas is a big step, big hard step. And I don't think it comes very easily. And one of the things that always has amused me is a few years ago in the Royal Albert Hall at the end of the proms season, they have this big, lovely sing-song, and everybody likes a good tune. You have to try to ignore the words, of course. So they all join, link arms and sway backwards and forwards and wave the Union Jack and have a good time to themselves singing Land of Hope and Glory and the various sea shanties. And I doubt whether many people, and there's couple of thousand people at least in the Albert Hall, and they would all have a huge variety of different ways of thinking about things. But at that time, they are linked by this enthusiasm, possibly for the British Empire. That was the argument against continuing singing these songs, but it might not be that, it might just be joining together for a good night sing song. But it does show that there is a wanting to belong, a feeling of unity in your life, that maybe we are asking people to give up without actually being able to supply any other linking, because there isn't yet the activity within society to make it seem necessary to go forward. I don't know if I'm making sense here. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you, John. Lovely talk.
Yeah, I think that does make sense, because like you say about religion, you gave it up, and then you realised after a while, you know what, I don't actually need this, and probably didn't need it all along. But particularly with things like religion, it encourages people to expect there to be an answer for, you know, what is it they say, one size fits all, an answer for every question. Whereas sometimes the correct answer is we don't know. There's nothing wrong with not knowing. What you want to do, if you possibly can, is find out. But it is true, people would like to belong to something, and this is a particularly difficult thing to deal with, because if they jettison a lot of the ideas of capitalism, they can find, you know, they'll fall out with perhaps members of the family, and it might become more awkward for them. So I think there probably are a lot of people who are developing similar ideas to ours, but maybe a bit frightened to take it much further.
Very interesting comments there, Janet, about the need for community. You know, people do have that need. I suppose the pity is that they find it in what I referred to earlier as narrow nationalism. The need is there. And you know, I suppose what we would say is that in a socialist society, that need would be fulfilled in all sorts of different ways in which capitalism can't fulfil it, but not an easy thing to put across.
No.
Paddy, over to you.
I can't help thinking, I mean, we take quite a materialist sort of view on things, but you know, other people don't. And I remember years ago having a discussion about the independence movement in Catalonia with a Catalonian friend of mine. I was visiting and I was at their house, and you know, she was quite young, and she was going on about, you know, the culture of Catalonia and the language and, you know, the whole history and how, you know, how they were sort of co-opted into, you know, Castilian Spain in the sort of, I don't know, the 14th century or something like that. And, you know, all this sort of aspect of it. And then I started talking to her dad, who was one of these kind of, you know, polymaths who could speak about nine languages. And, you know, he spoke perfect English, and it was only about his fourth language. But anyway, I was talking to him, and he was quite a well-to-do architect. And I said, well, what's your view of this? Because, you know, I'd spent ages saying to, you know, my friend, well, you know, you say it's about the culture and the language, but, you know, my feeling, it's my suspicion, it's really about the money. And because Catalonia's got most of the resources, it's got most of the industry, it's got most of the water, and it's got most of the money, which is being siphoned off to sort of bail out all the poor areas of Spain, especially in the south. I believe that it's very much the same situation you got in America, where the rich northern states, or comparative rich northern states, are basically bailing out all the southern states apart from Texas. Texas is the only southern state which is in sort of economic surplus. So I put this to her dad, and he basically said, yeah, basically it is. It's about the money and the resources. You know, we're bailing out the rest of Spain, and if we weren't doing that, you know, the economy and the standard of living in Catalonia would be a lot better than it is. So, you know, there's two different viewpoints from the same family. And, you know, I felt that, you know, the economic argument here was the strong one, and all the rest was, well, it was sort of smoke and mirrors in a way, really. And I remember seeing something, not when the whole Scottish independence thing was happening last time, there was a sort of there was a news piece from Shetland, and it was a little bit of a sort of five minute information piece on Shetland. And apparently, now Shetland did really well out of oil revenues. I'm not quite sure how this worked, but they managed to keep all their oil revenues and plough them into public works. So in Shetland, you've got lots of quite well-resourced public amenities like libraries, swimming pools, schools. It's all pretty well financed. And I can't remember why it was, but Shetland did well out of oil revenues, but Scotland on the whole didn't do well out of them. I don't know whether they all got paid into the Westminster Exchequer or what was going on. But anyway, there was this argument that the Shetlanders were putting. And one of the Shetlanders said a really interesting thing. He said, the SNP are arguing that Edinburgh is too far away from London. Westminster is too far away from Scotland to properly represent the interests of Scottish people, which sort of intuitively feels like it might be true. But the Shetlanders said, well, by the same token, Edinburgh is too far away from Shetland to represent our interests, so we wouldn't back Scottish independence. So I thought that was quite interesting, but especially as it came off the back of this economic imbalance between, you know, the economy in Shetland and the general economy in Scotland. So there we go. That's my general point. But I would think we don't hear a lot about the economic arguments behind nationalism. I mean, what is actually the SNP's economic case? And maybe we would be, if we were discussing this in, I don't know, future issues of the Standard or whatever it is, now, how would we sort of go at the economic arguments behind, you know, any sort of nationalist argument, particularly the SNP in this case?
Well, they used to see it as Scotland's oil, but the oil's become less important now. And the SNP did exist before the oil was discovered, but that was a sort of godsend to them in a way, you know, because they used to put up quite dishonest advertisements saying this oil is Scotland's, and then they would say things like, this represents £6,000 for every household in Scotland, or stuff like that. And well, okay, if you were to divide it up, maybe that would be true, but of course we know the reality of capitalism is that these oil companies are not going to take that wealth and hand it over to a lot of workers. I mean, that's just daft by capitalist standards. But I did hear the thing that about the Shetlanders. I heard that more recently. Someone in Shetland talking about Edinburgh being just as remote to them as London was, if not even more so. And they had, you know, some interest in their Scandinavian heritage. But one of the things they thought about the economics of the situation was they wanted to become, some of them did, wanted to become something like the Isle of Man or Guernsey, or I forget what you call these territories, but they're crown, I don't think it's crown dependencies, but it's some special something or other of the crown. And it gives them all sorts of fiscal advantages, you know, as small nations almost, or statelets. But that's something I heard on the radio recently.
Thanks, Paddy. Thanks, John. You know, Paddy, you mentioned the economic arguments in favour or against nationalism. You know, what are the economic arguments? I think we'd have to say that any economic arguments are illusory, quite simply. That, you know, it'll make damn all difference one way or the other. Rather than sort of, you know, going to a lot of detail as to sort of you know, who might be better off and how and why. I noticed that Alan has put on link to Shetland Independence. I clicked on it and it's not taken me there. It's taken me all over the place, actually. But never mind. Adam, you're next.
Yeah, in the case of Scottish nationalism, I don't think there is any economic argument. There's no section of the Scottish capitalist class in Scotland that's got anything, you know, to benefit from Scottish separatism. The only people that would benefit will be the politicians who'll be able to call themselves you know ministers and have embassies and jobs. I don't think you can say with Catalonia that there could be an economic argument. I can't think of any economic argument, even in capitalist terms, for Scottish separatism and Scottish independence. I mean, it's, you know, in the context of the British Isles, I mean, Ireland, south of Ireland, you know, broke away and tried to go it alone. But then they had the Anglo-Irish Free Trade Agreement, and England and Ireland, you know, became one economic unit. And then they, you know, went into the common market. I don't see any economic rationale, even from a capitalist point of view, for Scottish separatism. But I wanted to say something about communities. I mean, a more logical community for people would be people that speak the same language. But I think, that isn't the case in between England and Scotland, but it is to a lesser extent between England and parts of Wales. But I think, you know, language can be separated from, it can be promoted and protected without having an independent state. I mean, Welsh is much more alive than Irish, despite the fact that, you know, Irish is has had, you know, state protection and state promotion, and the Welsh language problem, if you like, has more or less been solved. There's a Welsh language television program. There's most signs in Wales are now bilingual, even in parts of Wales where they haven't spoken Welsh since before the Romans came. I mean, you know, Chepstow, which is just on the border with England before the Severn Bridge, it's a typical English town. You know, no different from places in Herefordshire, but you go there, and the signs are bilingual. Ironically, in the place where my brothers still live in, the council hasn't got enough money to have, you know, bilingual road signs. But as I say, in relatively rich Chepstow, the council has. But to come back to the point I'm trying to make. That in a socialist society, there'll still be language groups, and that, I think, that's an obvious community. But of course, the other thing is, of course, most people in the world are at least bilingual, you know, because they have to be. I think you can separate the language question from having a separate state. Languages don't need a separate state to be protected or promoted.
Yeah, well, an interesting thing in Scotland is that it has benefited from this rise in nationalism. What I mean by it is the Gaelic language, which is only spoken by, I think, less than 100,000 people. It's only the native language of perhaps 80,000 people in the Western Isles. But now it's taught in some schools, and you have the absurdity of Queen Street in Glasgow having bilingual signs in a language that nobody speaks. Police vehicles have now got, like they have in Wales. I used to think it was the name of a place. They call them, oh, I forget what the word is, but I saw this word and I thought it was the name of a place, but it turns out it's the name for the police. Well, they've got done the same thing with Scottish Gaelic. They've got poily ass. For, I mean, most people in Scotland just don't know what the fuck does that mean. Yeah, no disrespect to the people that speak that language. That's I can see how people that speak a language might be saddened by the fact that perhaps their language will die out quite soon. But it's alive and well in the Western Isles, and these people are perfectly bilingual. They can move quite easily between English and, for some of them, it is their own language. But, you know, so a lot of myths get perpetrated by the nationalists, and they've gone to an unnecessary extent of publicising a language that most people are not interested in. In fact, that probably dates right back to Roman times, the similarities between the south of Scotland and the rest of the, you know, like south of the border, England and so on. That probably dates back to Roman times. And these lowlanders have got less in common with the northern people, historically anyway. I mean, today we're all wage slaves, so it doesn't really matter. But from the point of view of language, you know, well, there never was a separate Scottish language. If the south of Scotland had been capable of supporting more people than the whole of England, then possibly the language would be called Scottish instead of English. It's just, you know, it's like Henry VIII noticed. He wasn't worried by the fact that one of his descendants might come from Scotland and take over the English throne, because he said, well, the larger nation will naturally dominate. But anyway, that's just a strange thing that with the rise of nationalism, we've got a language that nobody really, well, very few people use, but it's been promoted to, I would think, quite a lot of people think, an absurd degree in Scotland.
Thanks, John. Alan's put a different link on now for one of his blogs on independence for Shetland. Just read it. Very good indeed. It's about the history of the Shetland Isles, and throws some interesting light on how the Shetlands have developed and how history has led to all sorts of sort of different claims on it and about it, and how. What people are saying today in the Shetlands about independence or otherwise has been very much influenced by what's happened in the past. But I find very interesting the idea that it was once a Norwegian province, and a form of Old Norse was the common language there. Language, of course, it's a different argument. Well, it's an additional argument anyway to nationalism and patriotism and so on, isn't it? You know, maybe we could have a session on that one day. That would sort of throw up lots of interesting points, I think.
Yeah, that is a very interesting subject, because where does language end? Where does it stop being a dialect and start becoming a separate language? I've got a thing that I'm quite irritated by, the people refer to a Scots language, but really it's just a version of English. But as I've said, you know, if more people could have been supported in the south of Scotland than could be supported in the whole of England, the chances are they'd have called it Scottish, because that's the language that most people have always spoken in Lowland Scotland. There never was, and I hope there never will be, a separate Scottish language.
But sorry, John, Scottish Gaelic isn't a version of English, is it?
No, but that's in Lowland Scotland. That was very.
Yeah,
wasn't really spoken. It was, you know, the people in Lowland Scotland always were more interested. The thing about the history of England and Scotland, the history of Scotland has been more interested in the history of its larger neighbour, England, than the other way about. So Scottish history has been kind of peripheral to the main history of England. But in Scotland, they've always quite anxiously paid attention to what's going on in England, and you know, it's just it's been intertwined for a lot longer than people realise. You know, long before the formal uniting of either the crowns or the parliaments.
But what I'm saying is the 100,000 who are still speaking Scottish Gaelic, they're not speaking a version of English, are they? They're speaking a Celtic language, which is different. It's spoken in the north of Scotland rather than the south, but that is a different language, isn't it?
Oh, yes, that is a different language, but it's just never been the language of Scotland. You could never say it was the language of Scotland.
Okay, Adam?
Just on this last point about Gaelic, I think it came from Ireland, didn't it? I mean, the people originally came from Ireland. I don't know whether I read somewhere that the language that the Celtic language that they spoke in Glasgow was Welsh and not Gaelic. And these people who speak it in the Western Isles, their ancestors originally came from Ireland. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think Scottish Gaelic is related to Irish. I mean, at some point they were probably the same language, but I mean, in the Western Isles, I've noticed that people just speaking English sound a bit Irish to me. And I'm never sure whether they're Scottish or Irish. It's a bit like, well, it's not quite as bad as listening to Scotty in Star Trek, but it's to them, they must think I'm a bit like that because I can't discern which one's Irish and which one's Scottish. And, you know, certainly if they, you know, they can speak Gaelic and Irish and both groups can kind of understand large chunks of each other's language. So there's obviously a connection there.
Thanks, John. We're perhaps coming to the end of the discussion now. It's 9:15. We've been going for quite some time.
Yeah.
Unless there's anybody wants to throw that into the ring now to say something, perhaps ask John if he wants to round off things, make any kind of closing comment. You don't have to, John, but if you'd like to.
Not that I can think of. I think we've probably, well, they can never exhaust the subject, but I certainly can't think of much more to say at the moment, except to just reiterate what I've said before, that nationalism is no use to us and no use to the workers.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much. Been a very interesting discussion anyway. Okay. Thanks very much to everyone for attending.